you are able for the reading of the gospel. The words of scripture this morning are taken from Mark 14, verses 53 through 72. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes were assembled. Now the chief priest and the whole council were looking for testimony against Jesus to put him to death. The high priest asked him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Then the chief priest tore his clothes and said, "Why do we still need witnesses? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?" All of them condemned him as deserving death. Some began to spit on him, to blindfold him, and to strike him, saying to him, "Prophesy." The guards also took him over and beat him. While Peter was in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she stared at him and said, "You also were with Jesus, the man from Nazareth." But he denied it, saying, "I do not know or understand what you are talking about." After a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, "Certainly, you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." But he began to curse, and he swore an oath, "I do not know this man you are talking about." At that moment, the cock crowed for the second time. Then Peter remembered that Jesus had said to him, "Before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times." And he broke down and wept. May God's blessing be added to the reading of this word. Please be seated.
As you're seated, I invite you to take out of your bulletin your sermon notes and study guide. Your sermon notes are an outline of today's message. I'd like to encourage you to follow along and write down the things you'd like to remember and reflect upon in the coming week. And if you look at the bottom of your sermon notes, you'll notice that we're now including questions for discussion at lunch or supper or brunch. And I'd like to encourage you to take this with you and be able to talk about the sermon, to talk about the things that spoke to you. And so each week I'm including several questions that will help prompt your or help your mealtime discussion about the message. I'd like to encourage you to do that. On the back side, you'll find a study guide. And this week you're going to do something a little different. This week you're going to be reading the same account. You're going to be reading this account of the trial by the Sanhedrin and Peter's denial of Jesus in all four Gospels. So I'm going to invite you to take a piece of paper this week and make four columns, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Write down some of the details and look for the differences and similarities between those. Now, this will seem a bit repetitious. So you'll be reading the account the second and the third day. You will have read this account already, and you'll read it again, and you'll read it again. Each time you'll find there are subtle differences between the accounts. But I want you to pray before you read it and just say, "God, help me to hear something this time that I didn't hear last time I read this account. I've read this story hundreds of times, and this week in studying it, I spent hours studying it, and I saw new things every time I would sit down and read the account." So I want you to read this from all four Gospels. And then on the very last day, you're going to have a chance to read how the denial of Jesus by Peter is resolved in the Gospel of John. So I think you'll be blessed as you take the time to do this Bible study on your own. Today we do continue in our series of sermons on 24 hours that changed the world, the last 24 hours of Jesus' life. We began 2 weeks ago with a study of the Last Supper that Jesus ate with his disciples, the Passover Seder, which he transformed into Holy Communion, or the Eucharist. Then last week, Pastor Yolanda led you in a study of what happened after the supper when the disciples went across the Kidron Valley to the Garden of Gethsemane, how Jesus went and prayed in agony while the disciples fell asleep, how Judas Iscariot, one of the 12 disciples, had betrayed Jesus and brought the temple guards to arrest him, betraying Jesus with a kiss. And you learned about what the disciples' activities mean for our lives today. Now, this morning, we pick up the story with Jesus having been bound by the temple guards, and now they're preparing to take him to the high priest's home. He will be tried by the Sanhedrin. He will give his own testimony about his life, and then Peter will deny him. And we're going to be asking the question, what do these stories mean for us today? What do they tell us about ourselves? What do they tell us about Jesus? We're going to find a great deal more than might first be supposed when you read the text. Let's begin, though, with what literally happened. Let's take a look at the map on the video screen. And I would encourage you, if you don't have a Bible with good maps in the back, you really should acquire one. We have them in the bookstore, and the maps will help you really put into your mind what's happening and where it's happening. This is a map of the city of Jerusalem from Jesus' day. You'll notice on the top right-hand portion of the map, the Garden of Gethsemane. It's at the base of the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives rises up to the right-hand side of the screen above the Garden of Gethsemane. The Garden of Gethsemane, from here you can see the Temple Mount. So while Jesus was praying, he could see the temple across the Kidron Valley. There is then a valley that swoops down from top to bottom on this map between the Garden of Gethsemane and the city walls of the city of Jerusalem. Jesus is arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, and then he begins to make his way down, being led hand and foot bound. He's led by the temple guard down the Kidron Valley. As he does so, he's walking past the temple. He's walking past the gates where the book of Ezekiel says the Messiah will one day place his feet. He's walking past the pinnacle of the temple, where we're told that he was tempted by the devil, taken to the pinnacle of the temple, and dared to cast himself down and prove that he was the Messiah in this way. He walks past this place. He continues to walk down the Kidron Valley, past the old city of David, where David, who had been his predecessor as king over Israel 1,000 years before, had built his city in Jerusalem. He comes down to the very bottom of that map, and you'll see there's a body of water. That's the Pool of Siloam. This is the place where Jesus, in John's Gospel, had sent a man who was blind. Jesus had taken dirt and spit in it, made a mixture of mud, and placed it on the man's eyes, sent him to the Pool of Siloam to wash, and after he washed in the pool, he was finally able to see. And so we find the Pool of Siloam that Jesus walks past. Then he walks into the city of Jerusalem, into the lower city, and he begins to climb the stairway all the way to the house of Caiaphas in the upper city of Jerusalem. This is the palace of the high priest. This is the journey that Jesus makes that night. It's about 1 mile. It would have taken about 20 minutes for Jesus to walk from the garden to this place. It was probably somewhere just after midnight, Thursday night, Friday morning. Now, when I was in the Holy Land the last time, I shot some footage of this journey, and at least this last portion of it. I want you to see the church that's been built on top of what was believed to be the house of Caiaphas, the place where Jesus was tried. This is the church called St. Peter Gallicantu. Gallicantu is a French word, which means cock crow. And these are the ancient Roman steps leading through the lower city up to this place. Our guide suggested that we might want to take off our shoes, and I took off my shoes and walked barefoot on these stairs where Jesus himself had walked 2,000 years ago, being led to his trial by night. As you walk into the house, or into the church, you walk in at the lower level, and you go down 2 floors below ground, and you find this prison cell, what once was a cistern, and it's the place where Jesus would have been kept underground while he was being tried. They would have lowered him down through a hole in the ceiling, and he would have been placed there. And while I was there, after the rest of our group left that room, I sat down there in the darkness, just closed my eyes, and I imagined what it was like for Jesus that night as he listened to the Sanhedrin debating his fate in the courtroom above. Now, let's talk about what was taking place this evening. The Sanhedrin was a council of 71 elders, wise sages of the people of Israel. These are the most pious men in that time. 71 people, this comes from Numbers chapter 11, verse 16, where 1,200 years before, God had said to Moses, "Moses, it's not good for you to rule the people by yourself. You need some help. Call for me 70 of the elders, and they'll join you in ruling over the people." And so there were 70 plus Moses, there were 71. In Jesus' day, the Sanhedrin was 71. They were ruling over the religious affairs of the people. The Romans ruled over the political affairs. And so these 71 had control of the temple. They had control of the religious beliefs. They had control of the religious courts. And these 71, again, were the most pious, considered the most pious religious leaders of their time. The high priest would have been the pope of this time. He would have been the leading religious figure of his day. Now, part of what you want to see is the tragic irony in this story. You almost need to step back from it for a moment and realize at a cosmic level what's happening. Christians believe that in Jesus, God walked in human flesh on this earth. That just like an emperor who likes or longs to know the subjects that he rules over, and the emperor comes and puts on ordinary clothes and acts like a common person living among the people, no one really recognizing or understanding, the God of the universe chose to walk in human flesh on this planet as an itinerant preacher, a teacher, a carpenter, a healer. He was a pauper. And in this time, in this place, when God is walking in human flesh, the people who arrest him and try him are the most pious and religious people on the face of the planet. Do you see the irony in this? That the God who they claimed to serve had come and walked among them in flesh, and they could not see him. Not only could they not see him, the people you would expect to recognize and hail him, they did not see and recognize him, but note what they did. They have a trial by night. Now, the Sanhedrin met during the daytime. It didn't meet at night. In fact, its rules were not to meet at night. It met during the day and met in the temple courts, not in the high priest's house. It met in the temple courts. It did not meet during the festivals. Now, this Sanhedrin calls itself together at night, not in the temple courts, but in the house of the high priest, and during the festival of unleavened bread. This is the most unorthodox trial. And the most pious people call God before them, and God comes before them. They do not recognize God in flesh, Jesus the Messiah. They don't recognize him, and they begin to try him. Finally, they convict God of a crime worthy of death. They convict the Lord of blasphemy against himself. Do you see the tragic irony in this? And then they condemn him to death, and after this, these pious men begin to spit on him. And then they blindfold him so they can mock him. And they strike him, and they say, "Prophesy and tell us now, who was it who struck you?" And then they turn him over to the guards to beat him again. Do you feel the pain of this story? What human beings did when God walked in flesh. And I've heard it said from some of my friends who are non-religious. They say, "You know, I'd really believe in God if he'd just show up. If he'd come and knock on my door, I would believe in him if he'd just appear to me like that." He did that once. And this is what humanity did to him. Now, you'd understand that had you been a part of the Sanhedrin, you would have participated in these same things. There's not a single one of us. I recognize myself in the Sanhedrin. I would have made the same decision. I would pray I would not have, but I'm afraid I would have. And so would you. Now, the story is not simply about 71 Jewish men who were supposed to be pious in the first century. This is about the human condition. This is about who we are as human beings. Why did they do this? Why did the Sanhedrin fail to see? Not only why did they fail to see, why did they act in this way? Why did they condemn an innocent man to death? Why did they, even if they thought he was a false Messiah, well, why would they spit on him? Pious men, why would they spit on him? Why would they blindfold him and strike him and mock him? Why? As I reflected on that this week, I think the answer is fear. Fear. We're all born afraid. Part of that's a mechanism that God has given us to protect ourselves. We call it the self-preservation instinct. And so inside of us, we have an instinct, an innate desire to be safe, to protect ourselves. And that protection mechanism is helpful. It's helpful when you're in a dangerous situation, and it tells you to either fight or flee. Fight or flee. And so you know that sometimes you have to fight, you have to work, you have to exert energy in order to save yourself, and sometimes you need to run from a situation. Fight or flee. Unfortunately, our self-preservation instinct is coupled with our sin instinct. There's something in us that's broken, in all of us, where we have a propensity to do the wrong thing, to twist what was meant to be good and to misuse those gifts, to distort them. And that's what happens with our self-preservation instinct. You know this. You know, in the workplace, when maybe this has never happened to you, but you've known people it's happened to, when someone is really succeeding, they're really doing a great job in the workplace, and their sales are going through the sky and going through the roof, and there's somebody else there who's not having a good year in sales. What is our instinct? Our instinct is to find reasons why that person really is doing this, and it's a fluke, or maybe they're sleeping with the boss, or maybe they're lying when they're out making sales calls. But what we begin to do is we begin to diminish the other person because we find ourselves threatened by their success. We find this happens when we look in our world and there are things that threaten us. When we feel our safety is at stake, when we feel afraid, we tend to act out in ways that aren't in keeping necessarily with our faith. Suddenly, doing the right thing, doing the moral thing or the loving thing is thrown out the window if our safety feels jeopardized. When we feel threatened as a society, as a race, we tend to do the wrong thing many times. And later on, only in hindsight, do we look back and go, "That really wasn't right." This week, I asked our Saving Grace production team, our video ministry, I said, "Could you find some images of ways that in the last 60 or 70 years, as a race, human beings have, because of their fear of others who are different from themselves, because of their fear, their lack of security, we were willing to do things that today we recognize were not appropriate. Not only not appropriate, today we recognize they were just outright wrong. But because of our fear, we were willing to do them. Jesus was a threat to these men. He was a threat to everything that they knew and believed in. He threatened the social order. He threatened their authority, their standing within the community. When he preached, there were crowds who came to listen to him. And when they came to listen to him, they often said, "He preaches with such authority and not like our chief priests." Caiaphas, the high priest, the pope of the first century, said this to his fellow Jews. He said, "You know, this man is dangerous. If people continue to flock to him, the Romans are going to get wind of this, and who knows what they'll do to our people. This might actually lead to a great deal of pain for the entire nation, and certainly to ourselves. It would be better for one man to die than for all the people to suffer. Jesus must die." It is our history as a human race to be afraid of those who are different, to be afraid of the world that we know now changing, so that we react in fear. And fear gives birth to hate. And many times, out of our fear and hate, we end up doing the wrong thing. Today's the three-year anniversary, or this weekend is the three-year anniversary of the war in Iraq. And as a nation, we're still struggling with, was that the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? And 3 years ago, 70% of the population said it was the right thing to do. And today, 70% say it was the wrong thing to do. And history will determine and judge. We'll look back over time and decide whether this was the right thing or the wrong thing. There is no debating about the courage of the men and women who are serving there. I have been praying for the last year for four men. Every morning when I wake up, I get on my knees. I have their pictures on my kneeler. I've been praying for John and David and John and Craig. Craig is a part of our congregation, and these other three guys are in his platoon. And I've been praying for God's safekeeping for them and for God's care and protection and wisdom for them and for them not to be afraid. And how grateful I was that they and their entire platoon came home safe just last week. What a joy that was for us. And now I'm praying for another young man who is in his late 30s or mid-30s. He's my uncle who is now stationed in Iraq. And so we continue to pray, and we recognize that there is great courage in a company of people who are going at the request of their country to serve and who are striving to see a better Iraq in the future. And now that we're there, regardless of how you feel we got there and whether you thought we should have been there or not, we have an obligation to try to help make Iraq in the future better than it's been in the past. And there are many people who have great courage who are Iraqis, who are serving alongside U.S. forces. They're in the police and they're in the military, and they don't go for 18 months and then come back. They're going to live there forever. And with great fear for their families, for their children and their wives and their parents, they've decided to try to forge a better Iraq for the future. And so we pray for the people there, and we hope for a better future for them. So we can't go back and change the decisions that were made in the past. We can't change the fact that the United States initiated a preemptive war there and deposed the ruling powers, nor in Afghanistan just before that. We have to decide that we're going to support what's happening today and trying to build a better Iraq. But here's what I want to challenge you to do. However you see what happened there, some of you on either side of that debate when it comes to the war in Iraq, but when it comes to the future, not the past, but the future, you as Christian people, you have to ask questions. You have to be willing to ask questions. Is this the thing that's going to bring about the greatest possible results? Is waging a preemptive war the right thing to do in this situation? You may decide it is. You may decide it's not. But you have to ask that in the light of your faith. You are people who've said, "I follow Jesus Christ." Envision in your own mind talking to him and saying, "Lord, what would you tell us to do? If you could go on national TV, what would you tell us to do today in this situation? What is the right thing? Not only what is it that our fears tell us to do, but what is the right thing to do here?" And however you come out on that, I can't think for you. You have to think for yourself, but you have to think. You have to at least apply your faith to the problems that we're facing in this world, because the history of humankind is a history of us doing things out of fear, and then when we look back, us saying, maybe we should not have done that after all, or maybe we should have done this. And so when I look at the Sanhedrin, I see myself. I recognize that I would have been one of those folks who could have voted for the Jim Crow laws that reigned for 70 years in America, that said we could really have separate but equal, and it was better for whites and blacks not to drink from the same drinking fountain or sit in the same places in the restaurant. I might have voted for that because of my fears. I might have hooked up those electrodes to the man in Abu Ghraib prison and put the hood on his head and shocked him because I was afraid of what he stood for, or what he might stand for, or what information he might have that I couldn't get out of him. I might have done that. And I probably would have sat in the Sanhedrin and said, crucify him. Fear motivates us to do things later on. We say, what were we thinking? Preachers know about fear. It's easy to use fear to motivate people in the church. It's something we have to be careful about. It's easy around a stewardship campaign, the time you're raising money, to talk about how the world is going to hell in a handbasket, and if only you'll give a little more money, the church is going to be okay, and we'll save the world from the terrible things that are happening. I was watching television while I was on vacation this week. There was a lot of religious programming in Florida, where we were. And it was interesting, one particular program, LaVon saw, a pastor was promising folks that if you drank just one drop of water from this particular bottle that had been blessed by the pastor, it would make you well. And then talked about the kind of sicknesses we all struggle with, and then had people giving testimonials about how that one drop of water had healed them. And it was only $1,000 a bottle. And that sounds like a pretty interesting fundraising plan to me, something right out of the snake oil days in America. But you know, if you can play upon people's fears, you can convince them to do all kinds of things. It's not only preachers that do that. Politicians do that, too. And you know, in 2 years, we're going to be having the Republicans and the Democrats both trying to scare us into voting for their candidate. That's how it works, unfortunately. When you act out of fear, we often do the wrong thing. Now, I'm reminded of this passage of Scripture in 1 John. 1 John chapter 4, which says this: God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in him. In this way, love is made complete among us so that we will have confidence on the day of judgment. Because in this world, we are like him. Now listen to this. There is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear. We love because he first loved us. If anyone says, I love God, yet hates his brother, he is a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. The question that we ask in our personal lives and in public policy as Christians is this: not what is the thing that will make me feel most secure, but what is the most loving thing for me to do? And in the end, love conquers in ways that fear and hate and violence simply cannot do. That's what the Scriptures teach us about the ways of God. Now, there's one last word about the Sanhedrin trial that I would lift up. There were 71 members of the Sanhedrin. They're listening to Jesus. They're looking at what's happening. They're hearing the call for his crucifixion. I cannot believe that all 71 of these men believed that they were doing the right thing and spitting upon him, beating him, and calling for his death. Do you think that would have been the case, that all 71 of those people, not a single one of those wise sages, was having second thoughts or maybe feeling the Holy Spirit speaking in their hearts or saying, gosh, this just doesn't seem right? But you know, in all the Gospels, as far as I recall, every one of the Sanhedrin members agreed to his death. Now, how did that happen? Here's what I know, is that points to another part of the human condition. And that is that if there's a whole bunch of people who are saying the same thing, I tend to be too afraid to stand up and say something different from what everyone else is saying. I've seen this in my life from the time I was a kid up until my grown-up years. There were times that people who were in authority were saying, this is the way we ought to go, and I didn't want to buck authority, or I didn't want to say something that might make me look foolish or stupid, or maybe I had the wrong answer, and so I just was quiet, and I didn't say anything at all. And then later on, wished that I had the courage to speak up. I have a feeling that there were people in that Sanhedrin who later on said, why didn't I say anything? Why didn't I say anything? I'm reminded of that famous quote, you've heard it before, from Pastor Martin Niemöller, who was a Lutheran pastor in World War II in Germany, under Nazi Germany. He was one who saw the sins and the woes of the Jewish people, or the sins that were happening against the Jewish people, and at first he refused to speak up. Only later did he begin to speak out against what he'd seen. The quote's often cited in different ways. This is how it was most recently in Time magazine. It says, first they came for the communists. Niemöller writes, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, and by that time there was no one left to speak up anymore. I'm reminded of that famous quote from the 18th century British philosopher and politician Edmund Burke, when he wrote, the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. That's a sin as well. Keeping silent, doing nothing when you see something is wrong. I was thinking this week as I was reading the newspaper about the Enron trial that continues, and Andrew Faustdal was giving his testimony about him, his own culpability, and Jeffrey Skilling now and Ken Lay are on trial, and you remember the whole story of Enron and its collapse. And I began to wonder this, what would have happened when the first board meeting or the first staff meeting, when anyone began to talk about having offshore accounting structures like Enron developed, what would have happened surely when they're talking about it, somebody around the table saying, gosh, this doesn't feel right. Don't you think somebody was saying that doesn't feel right, but they didn't say anything. What would have happened if just one person would have said, guys, I don't mean to be critical, but I don't think this feels like the right thing to do. It just doesn't seem right. What might have happened? I'm not talking about the whistleblower after the whole thing was over and done and the company was ready to collapse. I'm talking about at that first meeting, if one person had spoken up, I'm guessing that most of the people at Enron would still have their retirement, that Skilling and Faustdal and Lay would not be looking at jail sentences. Instead, maybe because one person raised a question, at that early stage, the rest of the group would have said, hey, you know, let's talk about this some more. Maybe this isn't right. Now, I'm not talking about you going out pointing out other people's sins. You know, that's just obnoxious when Christians go around and point to everybody else's sins. And we all know Christians who are like that. I'm not saying that. I'm saying when you're being invited to do something or you're a part of a group like the Sanhedrin and something wrong is happening and you're a part of that group, part of what we have to do is to be able, and you can do this with great humility and great caution, to be able to say, guys, I just have a question. It just doesn't seem right. But to be able to raise your voice. Or when you see injustice being done to someone else, and you know inside there's just this sense, this just doesn't feel right, and you're still afraid. You don't know, should you say something or not? Say something. Say something. Last night, a woman, while I was preaching, sitting right over here, began to weep while I was preaching. And at the end of the sermon, I was walking out, at the end of the service, I was walking out, and she grabbed hold of my hand, and she said, you know, when you came to that moment in the service, you were talking about the Sanhedrin being silent. And she said, I remembered when I was in fifth grade, and we were on the playground, and there was this kid who was being beat up by the other kids, and I just knew it was wrong, and I was watching what they were doing, and finally one of the kids took that big old boot, you know, what we used to call the waffle stompers, and placed it and began to press down on this child's head on the playground. And I was too afraid to say anything. And she said, you know, that was 30 or 40 years ago, and I still think about that regularly. And after that time, I was so ashamed of myself when I didn't speak up, that from that time forward, I decided I would never again keep silent when I saw something like that happening. All it takes is one person sometimes to speak up. What would have happened at the Sanhedrin if one or two or three of those Sanhedrin members had simply said, this isn't right, it's not in keeping with what God teaches us, regardless of what we think about this man, this can't be right. Are you willing to speak up? All right, well, we shift gears and we look at what Jesus says about himself in this story. We can't miss this. Jesus is on the witness stand. I mean, they've been bringing in false witnesses and they can't agree. And according to the Jewish law, two people have to agree in their testimony in order to convict. They couldn't get two testimonies that were in agreement. And so finally, they look at Jesus, the high priest, frustrated, says, look, just tell us, will you? Are you the Christ? Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? And Jesus gives this answer. Only one sentence long, and you could read past it and not even get what he was saying. There's a great deal of debate among scholars as to how much Jesus was aware of his own messiahship. How much did he understand about himself? And how much was he emptying himself of his godhood and couldn't understand who exactly he was? Well, traditionally we believe that Jesus understood throughout his entire public ministry where he was going, what he was doing, that he was the Messiah, that he would die for the sins of the people, that he was connected to God in a way no other human being ever had been. Well, we come to this testimony about himself and we hear from Jesus' own lips who he is. So are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? And this is what he says. Three things he says in this one sentence, three allusions to the Old Testament. The first thing he says is just two words. He says, I am. I am. Now, it's easy to read past that and just see it as an answer to the question, are you? I am. But the fact that Jesus doesn't say, I am he, or I am the Blessed One, or I am the Messiah, he just says, I am. What does he mean by that? In Greek, it's two words, ego, eimi, which is used in the Gospel of John regularly by Jesus in the I am sayings. But I want to remind you, when Jesus says I am, he's pointing towards something, and the high priest recognizes it, tears his garments as a result. You remember, 1,200 years before the time of Jesus, Moses is in the wilderness, he sees a burning bush. The burning bush speaks to him. God speaks to the burning bush and says, Moses, I want you to go and set my people free from slavery in Egypt. Go to the Pharaoh and demand that they be released and lead my people to a land I will show you. And Moses says, well, there are so many gods. Which one are you? What is your name? Do you remember what God said? He says, my name is I am that I am. And we mistranslate the Hebrew as Jehovah. That is the word, but it's really Yahweh. Yahweh is a Hebrew word. It means I am that I am. And God says to Moses, you go tell Pharaoh and the Israelites, I am sent you. When Jesus is looking at the high priest and he says, are you the Son of God, the Son of the Blessed One? Are you the Messiah? Jesus answers him, I am. I am being itself, God was saying in the Old Testament. I am life itself. All of existence springs forth from me. And Jesus is claiming that identity with God in this simple answer. He then goes on to say, and you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. Now, this is a reference to Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 and following. Let's take a look at this passage of Scripture. It's on the video screens. It reads, I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man. So Jesus uses this title of himself frequently in the Gospels. One like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. That's what he's just said to Caiaphas. He approached the Ancient of Days, that is God, and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshiped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Jesus makes the allusion of this text. He's counting on the fact that the high priest will fill in the rest of it, that this is about him. He's saying, I will come on the clouds of heaven. There will be a second coming, Jesus is saying, even here in his trial. I will come this way, and when I come, I will rule, and God the Father will grant to me dominion and authority and power over all people, and they will worship. Notice that they're going to worship him. Now, worship is reserved for God, and so this Son of Man is somehow connected with deity in order for the people to worship him. Finally, Jesus mentions the fact that he would sit at the right hand of power. Now, that's a reference to Psalm 110. Listen to Psalm 110, verses 1 through 4. Jesus has this in mind when he's on the witness stand. The Lord, that is Yahweh, says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. And so this Lord that he's referring to is Jesus, and the enemies are those who are sitting around that room who will become his footstool. Now they bristle at this. They understand and remember these words, no doubt. The Lord, Yahweh, sends out from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your foes. Your people will offer themselves willingly on the day you lead your forces on the holy mountains. From the womb of the morning, like dew, your youth will come to you. Now listen to this. The Lord, Yahweh, has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Now what is that about? Well, those of you who were here a couple of years ago when we did a series of sermons on Abraham learned about Melchizedek. 1600 years before the time of Christ, Abraham had just fought a battle. He comes to what was the city of Salem. That was the forebearer to the city of Jerusalem. So he comes to the city of Salem. Salem means peace. He meets the king of Salem, the king of peace, Melchizedek. The word Melchizedek, Malek Tzedekah, means king of righteousness. He's the king of peace. He's the king of righteousness. This mysterious figure comes out to meet Abraham, and he offers Abraham a meal of bread and wine. Do you remember just hours before this exchange takes place with the high priest, Jesus offers his disciples a meal of bread and of wine. Jesus is the king of righteousness. He is the king of peace. He is the one foretold even from the time of Abraham that he would come. Jesus is a priest and he is a king. He is a priest who offers himself as a sacrifice to atone for the sins of his people. He is the king of righteousness. He is the king of peace. All of this Jesus is saying in this one short testimony before the Sanhedrin. And with this, recognizing all that he just said, they tore their clothes and they said, do we need any more witnesses? This man has blasphemed. Or we would say he told the truth. This man has blasphemed, they said, and he's worthy of death. All right, there's one last part of today's story then. We have Jesus, who is making clear who he is. He's not simply a good teacher. Many people believe Jesus is a good teacher. Some people believe he's a great moral example. Some people believe he's a prophetic figure. Some would even go so far as to say he was a wonder worker. But Jesus says of himself that he is identified with the I am, that he is the king who is to come, the Son of Man who will come again, who will rule over all people, all flesh, and he is the priestly king, the king of peace, the king of righteousness. This is what Jesus says about himself. Now, this last part of the story is a bookend. So we started off with righteous people who did the wrong thing, and then we have Jesus' testimony about himself, and then we have the other bookend, which comes in Peter's denial of Jesus. Now, we look at Peter, and we can easily begin to look down upon Peter for denying Jesus. We see him perhaps as a coward, but you need to recognize the courage demonstrated by Peter up to this point. He was in the Garden of Gethsemane, and you remember the guards came to arrest Jesus, and what does Peter do? He's the only one we hear takes out a sword to fight. And he lops off the ear of the high priest's servant. Do you remember this part of the story? And in Luke's gospel, Jesus picks up the ear, puts it back on the man, and heals the man. And turns to Peter and says, this is not how it's going to play out, Peter. It's not going to be with swords that we conquer. It's going to be with a cross. It's going to be with sacrificial love that we conquer, not with might. So then Peter was courageous enough to try to fight for Jesus. Now, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke's gospel, we find that Jesus is led away, and the disciples flee. The disciples flee except Peter, and Peter follows at a distance. Now, he's the only disciple mentioned in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John tells us, hey, I was there too. And so John mentions that he was the second disciple who was there with Jesus. Peter walks some distance behind in the darkness, but he follows the guards as they take Jesus to Caiaphas' house. And it's there that Peter has the courage to go into the outer courtyard to see what's going to happen. Do you see the courage it took to do that? Would you have walked into the outer courtyard when your master was probably going to be put to death? They might put you to death. He did something bold and courageous here. But his courage only worked up to a point. And finally, there was a servant girl who came, and she said, you were with him. I know you were. And Peter, at this moment, too afraid to stand up as one of Jesus' disciples, now finally the fear takes over when there's danger of him being harmed. And he says, I don't know what you're talking about. He goes into the outer courtyard. He was in the inner courtyard. He goes into the outer courtyard. The woman finds him again and says, I know you were with him. I'm looking at you, and I know you were one of his disciples. And once more, he says, I have no clue what you're talking about. I don't know this man. Finally, there's a group of people who come up to him and say, we can tell by your speech you were one of his disciples, at which time he calls down curses from heaven upon himself, and he swears, I don't know the man. And at that moment, the cock crowed for the second time. And he remembered the words of Jesus foretelling that he would deny Jesus, and he began to weep bitterly. Luke's gospel tells us that moment Jesus looked from inside the house out at Peter, and Peter looked at him, and their eyes met, and he was convicted in the heart of what he'd just done to Jesus. Now, the reason why the story is in the gospels, all four gospels tell us the story. How did they find out the story? Peter's the only person who was there. Peter told the story. He told the story when he went to preach. He would tell them the story. He would say, I know you've denied Jesus. I denied him myself. I denied him in a way that I am so ashamed of. And yet I have to tell you, I betrayed the Lord, but he gave me grace. I denied him, but he took me back. And if you've denied him, he'll take you back too. From that moment forward, Peter would never deny Jesus again. He was so convicted from that time of denying him that he would stand up for Christ until finally, just before the Gospel of Mark was written, he was crucified upside down as a witness for Christ. Here's the reason why this story is in the text, is that all of us will betray Jesus. We will deny Jesus somewhere along the way. I'd ask you this question, when have you denied him? Not have you denied him, because I know you have. When have you denied him? I was in Israel the very first time I went was 7 years ago. And whenever you go to Israel, they say that every person has a moment where it's just a God moment. Something happens and you find yourself transported back into the Bible, into the biblical times. That happened for me on the very first night. We flew into Jerusalem and my body clock was all messed up and we were supposed to go to bed, but it was like 8 a.m. by my body's time. And so I tried to go to sleep. I laid there in bed, I tossed and turned, I napped for a little while, and finally, after hours of tossing and turning, I got up. I left LaVonna asleep in the bed, and I quietly tiptoed out. I put on a shirt and my blue jeans, and I went out front. And we were staying in a hotel on the Mount of Olives, overlooking the city of Jerusalem. And I went outside, and it was beautiful. It was dark outside, but the city was lit up, the Temple Mount with the Dome of the Rock. And I sat there under an olive tree on a bench. It was this time of year. It was March. It was the time of year in which Jesus was crucified. And it was cold. I was chilled because I didn't have a coat on. I sat out there and I was chilled and I was just thinking and praying and looking over the city. And as I was sitting there, a cock crowed. And in that moment, I felt like I was taken back 2,000 years. I was cold and shivering outside the high priest's house. And at that moment, I thought of all of the times that I had denied Jesus. I had denied him by saying and doing things I knew were not his will. I had denied him by being afraid to stand up and be counted as one of his disciples, afraid to stand up and speak when other people were calling upon me to do something that I knew was wrong. I had denied him so many times. And inside, all I could do, I just began to pray. I said, Lord, I am so sorry for all of those ways that I have denied you. We all have denied Jesus. I don't know how you've done it. I'd ask you this question, though, today. Are you willing to be counted as one of his disciples? Are you willing for people to know that you're a Christian? In the workplace, where you work, do the people know that you're a follower of Jesus Christ? Or have you been kind of timid about that because it might be a bit embarrassing? I had one of our parishioners who's moved away. She wrote me an email not long ago, and she said, Pastor Adam, I'm not calling myself a Christian anymore. I said, why? What do you mean? She said, well, I'm still a follower of Jesus, but she said, you know, I see all the things that some Christians do, some of the bigotry practiced in the name of Christianity, and some people who act in ways that I just don't feel, it just turns me off and turns me away from the gospel, and I don't want to be identified with that, so I'm not calling myself a Christian anymore. I said, listen, I understand what you're saying, but if you're not willing to call yourself a Christian, then that becomes the definition of Christianity, and I don't want that to be the definition of Christianity, so you've got to continue to say, I'm a Christian, and let people see that Christianity is different than maybe what they see in some other people. It's easy for us to be embarrassed and be afraid and timid about letting people know that we're a follower of Christ. In the corporate boardroom, do they know that you're a follower of Jesus? In your neighborhood, at Thanksgiving, when you're gathering with your family and you're the only one who goes to church, have you ever thought about saying, I know this is going to sound strange to you, but you know, I joined a church and I became a Christian this last year. Could I just say a prayer of thanksgiving for us? Not real preachy, just a short prayer of thanksgiving at the Thanksgiving meal. Would you be willing to try that? Or to stand up when somebody's doing something wrong and say, you know, I'm not sure that's right. Would you be willing to be counted as a follower of Jesus Christ? This story is meant to offer you grace when you've denied him, but it's meant to call you to boldness in faith. So here's what we've learned in this series, in this sermon today. We've learned about the Jewish Sanhedrin, about how righteous people, even righteous societies or societies that see themselves as righteous, can do the wrong thing when they're motivated primarily by fear and not by love. We've learned that there's a tendency in us to be silent in the face of those things that are wrong and not to speak up, and how if one person can speak up, things might change in the future. We've learned that Jesus is more than a great teacher and more than a prophet. He is the I Am. He is the King who will come again. He is our righteous priest. And we have learned that all of us have denied the Lord, and there is grace and mercy and new beginnings, and that God calls us to be bold and courageous and to be willing to stand up with Jesus Christ. And that's my invitation for you today. When you leave today, to be willing to be counted as one of his disciples. Would you pray with me? Oh God, you know how our hearts are not so different from those in the Sanhedrin. How individually and as a society, there have been times in our past when the land of the free and the home of the brave inflicted pain upon those who you sought to love. Help us, O God, to know what's right. It's sometimes confusing. Help us to act out of love and not out of fear. Help us to be bold and courageous and to be counted as your disciples. Help us in this, we pray. Forgive our sins and the times we've denied you. And help us to honor you, Jesus, the great I Am, the King who will come again, our righteous and holy priest. We offer ourselves to you in your holy name. Amen.